Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a brazen act of complicity between the House Majority Leader and Wall Street interests, witnessed today on Capitol Hill as Eric Cantor gutted the Stock Act, meant to stop insider trading by the Congress, and forced through the passage of a watered-down weak bill. Dr. Craig Holman, the legislative representative for Public Citizen on Capitol Hill, joins us to discuss Cantor's craven move and the outrage it has generated from lawmakers, including the Republican sponsor of the Senate's Stock Act bill, Chuck Grassley. Then we will speak with Paul Pearson, who is professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley, and co-author of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. We'll examine the capture of our government by the super rich and look into ways to restore a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Then finally, we'll speak with the communications director for the Syrian American Council, Rashad al-Dabbagh, who will discuss the ongoing tragedy in his native country as the Assad regime appears to be taking advantage of the Russian UN veto to ramp up its murderous military bombardment of the Syrian people who oppose the family dictatorship. And joining us now is Dr. Craig Holman, the legislative representative for Public Citizen. He serves as the organization's Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. He's an expert on campaign finance reform, government ethics, lobbying practices, and the impact of money in politics. Previously, Dr. Holman was a senior policy analyst at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Holman.
Glad to be here, Ian.
And the House has just passed the Stock Act, 417-2, but my understanding is that House Majority Leader Eric Cantor has stripped out some of the provisions, particularly those that require that this new industry that's cropped up on Capitol Hill called the political intelligence industry, which is a $100 million a year business with 30 to 50 firms operating in Washington alone, that those people who collect financial information and sell it to Wall Street don't have to register the same way that lobbyists do. So that seems like a massive gift to Wall Street.
It is a massive gift to Wall Street, and Wall Street and the banks and the financial services industry are Eric Cantor's biggest base of contributors. So he's given a gift back to his primary campaign contributors. The Stock Act, by the way, stands for Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act. You know, as all the listeners here probably realize, it's the insider trading laws that would send you and I to prison don't apply to members of Congress. And so finally, we've got some legislation that's been going through both the House and the Senate, not only applying the insider trading laws to members and staff, but also requiring, as you mentioned, disclosure by a whole host of lobbyists and businesses that hang around the halls of Congress to try to glean inside information from staffers and members and then sell it for trading on the stock market. They're called the political intelligence consultants. However, they tend to be mostly lobbyists and hedge fund firms and various financial traders that do that type of operation. Eric Cantor has given them a huge gift. We've got a real strong Stock Act that came through the Senate that included coverage of political intelligence consultants. The original bill in the House, H.R. 1148, by Representatives Tim Walz and Louise Slaughter, also covered political intelligence consultants, and that was what we had expected to go into today. But Eric Cantor pulled a fast one. He introduced a substitute measure and then imposed a rule that prohibited the discussion or consideration of any other bill or amendment. So the House was forced by Eric Cantor into either taking his weak package or get nothing at all. We all chose to go with the weak package at this point with the hope of pushing this into conference committee and, giving a chance for the advocates of a stronger measure, especially from the Senate and Louise Slaughter, to transform it back into the meaningful original measure that it was.
And New York Democratic Representative Louise Slaughter who, as you mentioned, Craig Holman, tried to get a bill similar to the Senate one through. She said, the Stock Act has been weakened totally as far as I'm concerned. So you have to take her word. She knows what she's talking about, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, not only did Eric Cantor cut out a huge gaping loophole for the political intelligence consultants, literally for Wall Street, but he also cut out a very important enforcement provision that would have made it much easier for the Department of Justice to enforce the nation's anti-corruption laws. So he took two of the biggest components that were in the Stock Act and cut them right out of the bill, and then forced the House to sign on to his version, which, you know, is a little, but it certainly isn't what everyone has called for. You know, the original Stock Act that Louise Slaughter and Tim Walz had sponsored got up to 282 co-sponsors. I mean, literally about two-thirds of the House was behind this bill. And Eric Cantor just snubbed his own colleagues and went forward with the substitute amendment.
So explain that to our listeners then, Craig Holman. How could somebody get away with such a brazen act of undemocratic behavior, basically being totally craven towards a particular special interest? And at this point, you know, Wall Street special interest is not the most popular in the land. How does he get away with it? What's the story with his constituents? I mean, I'm absolutely nonplussed.
You know, a lot of us are very angry at Eric Cantor for doing this. I mean, even his Republican colleagues in both the House and the Senate were condemning this action. This was essentially a parlor trick. You can take the rules of procedure of the House, and if you're the majority leader, you can manipulate those rules to do almost anything you want. Now, it's literally considered a bad form to ignore the wishes of two-thirds of your colleagues. But the House Majority Leader actually has that authority. By bringing his substitute measure up under the suspension calendar, the way the rules of procedure are designed, that means nothing else can be considered except the substitute measure being offered by the majority leader. And that's what he's done. He's snubbed his own colleagues. He's infuriated both the House and the Senate. And to tell the truth, I'm not at all convinced he's really going to win this battle. You know, he's trying to avoid going to conference committee, and actually, as a House Majority Leader, he can avoid calling a conference committee and essentially kill the bill right then and there. But at this point, the public pressure is so in tune as to what Eric Cantor just pulled off, and also so demanding of having this Stock Act pass, that I think Eric Cantor's put himself in a very precarious situation here, where he's not only defying the wishes of his colleagues, but he's defying the wishes of the American public. I'm not so sure he's going to win on this one.
So just to go over the history of the Stock Act a little, of course, the president in his State of the Union just recently called on the Congress to send him a bill that bans insider trading by members of Congress, and I'll sign it tomorrow. Well, we're not sure whether he's going to sign it. We're not sure whether it's going to go into conference. But you have to go back a little bit before. You mentioned all of the co-sponsors in the House, what, 250. But prior to 60 Minutes running a piece on the Stock Act and how it had languished for years and had only been able to get a couple of Congress people aboard, one of whom was Louise Slaughter, who's obviously been with us from the beginning. The other co-sponsor, I think he quit the House in disgust, didn't he?
Brian Baird, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he left. Tim Walz has taken over as lead on the Stock Act, along with Louise Slaughter. But yeah, the history is quite amazing. I mean, just to show how little Congress really wants to pass this law, the bill was introduced originally back in 2006. And it's never gotten more than a dozen co-sponsors on the bill. And as a matter of fact, this year we were only up to about six or seven co-sponsors. And then suddenly 60 Minutes did this good, excellent expose on insider trading by members of Congress and how many of them are getting filthy rich trading in the stock markets. And immediately after that, we went from about six co-sponsors to 282 today. So, I mean, it shows that Congress, if it really doesn't want this law, but they are being embarrassed into applying the law against insider trading to themselves. We'll see what the final result is going to be yet.
But Craig Holman, in that 60 Minutes piece, one of the most egregious revelations was that one of the congressmen, a Republican congressman from, I think, from Mississippi or Louisiana, was in on these critical negotiations just as Lehman Brothers was tanking and the Secretary of the Treasury was meeting with everybody behind closed doors, along with the chairman of the Fed and everybody. And they were in crisis and panic mode. And he was able to take information about who the Fed was going to bail out and who they weren't, and go out and make trades on this critical insider information. What's happened to him? I take it there'd be no censure on him. He's obviously working hand in glove with Cantor, right?
That's right, and probably voted for the Stock Act in the end. There's been quite a number of...
What's his name, by the way? His name slips me at the moment.
I believe you're talking about Representative Spencer Baucus.
Spencer Baucus, right.
Who is the chair of the Financial Services Committee. Right. So he's not only an insider, he's chair of the insiders. Mm-hmm. He's got his finger right on the pulse of what's going on in the financial services sector in Wall Street, and he has been essentially a day trader. I mean, if you take a look at his personal financial disclosure forms, this guy was all over the stock market trading in Citibank and Fidelity and all kinds of financial services stock. He's not the only one. I mean, literally, there are lots of Representative Boehner, for instance, had a lot of investments in the mortgage funds. And by coincidence, he cashed out on all his mortgage funds right before the mortgage industry collapsed. You know, he's just raised questions after questions. I mean, either these guys are geniuses at trading in the stock market, or they know something we don't know.
I'd go with the latter.
Yes, so would I. If you take a look at the overall financial wealth of Congress in just the last 2 years has increased by about 25%. You know, you got to ask yourself, how much has your wealth increased in the last 2 years?
Well, tell us a bit, Craig Holman, about the Senate bill. And you were telling us that Eric Cantor forced this vote on his version, which is the watered-down, diluted, Wall Street-friendly version of the Stock Act with these massive loopholes. And he has the ability not to go to conference. But clearly there's already Senator Chuck Grassley, who was the author of the Senate bill, apparently. He's furious with Cantor. You think it's possible to shame this guy?
Yes, I do. The game is afoot as we speak. Eric Cantor forced his weak bill through this morning, and in an effort to try to avoid going to conference where he thinks the Senate and people like Louise Slaughter will once again produce a good, strong bill in conference. In order to avoid that, just about an hour ago, he made an overture to the Senate saying, okay, we just take my bill, and if you just ratify my bill, it goes straight to the president by this afternoon. You know, trying to make it sound like we can do this reform real fast. And fortunately, Grassley and Cornyn and some others have spoken up, you know, furious about the dilution of the bill itself that Cantor did. And hopefully they will stand by their stronger version and demand that the Senate and the House go into conference and iron out the details. Now, we don't know what will eventually come out of conference, but you know, I suspect it might be pretty good. I know Nancy Pelosi's already committed to appointing Louise Slaughter to represent the Democrats on the House side in the conference committee. And if we can get some good senators, and there's a lot of them to choose from, like Grassley, you know, and Scott Brown and Kirsten Gillibrand, a bunch of good ones, and get them in the conference committee, then I suspect we're going to get a final good product. And I hope the Senate stands firm and does not endorse or take on Cantor's bill and stand firm and come out with their own strong one.
And Cantor, of course, called one of the provisions in his bill the Pelosi provisions, which was a dig at Nancy Pelosi, which I imagine didn't go down too well with her and her colleagues.
It also shows how Eric Cantor has taken this important piece of legislation and just turned it into partisan football. You know, to him, all it is some way in which he can try claiming credit for reforms by making it his bill, and then at the same time attacking his Democratic opponents like Nancy Pelosi with it. You know, he's just playing political football here, and this is not the issue to try to turn into partisan politics. It isn't going to work. I mean, you've got Senator Grassley out there publicly denouncing Eric Cantor on this, and, you know, Grassley is a fellow Republican.
Well, just in closing, apparently there's some concern about a Grassley provision in the Senate bill that might have an unintended consequence of muzzling whistleblowers. Tell me about that. Is that...
It's not a valid argument. What the point is, part of the lobbying campaign to try to kill the political intelligence consultants provision, which is being launched by Wall Street and the Chamber of Commerce. And one of the most effective ways of trying to kill a popular piece of legislation is to try to create confusion over how broadly it reaches. It's pretty clear that the political intelligence provision applies just to those who derive information, and this is a quote right out of the Grassley Amendment, which is intended for use in analyzing securities or commodities markets or informing investment decisions. So it very narrowly applies to those who are trying to glean information to use and at the time they glean it, to use it for trading in the stock market. So it does not apply to others, such as the media or whistleblowers or any of the others.
Well, it just shows you how you've got to be diligent, right, as a reporter, and you're there as a representative of public citizen on the Hill, because I'm reading this from the Huffington Post, and it sounds like it's real, but it's obviously a game. It's obviously a way to dirty up the real meat of the bill.
It is part of the lobbying campaign. You'll also see in the Grassley Amendment a specific provision that exempts the media from any coverage under this insider trading law. It's part of the game we play here on Capitol Hill.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Craig. Very appreciative of your close knowledge on this whole issue.
It is a pleasure, and we shall very shortly see whether we get a good stock act through this Congress.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Craig Holman, the legislative representative for Public Citizen. He serves as the organization's Capitol Hill lobbyist on ethics, lobbying, and campaign finance rules. He's an expert on campaign finance reform, governmental ethics, lobbying practices, and the impact of money in politics. Previously, he was a senior policy analyst at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment.
All that diamond dust. Blowing up your hopes, flamboyant obstacles, oh, deals made to cope, ideas in decline, rise of the lost, yeah, 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 hey, here we stand, slave to networks, master plans, swags the brand, open a can, chains off still, yeah, I never ran, but who do you think you are? You receive, but always want more. But the day is coming, the day is near, the day is coming, you know what I mean.
Welcome back, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Paul Pearson, who's Professor of Political Science at the University of California, Berkeley, the author of Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy and Politics in Time, History, Institutions, and Social Analysis. His latest book with Jacob Hacker is Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, which is just out in a new paperback edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Pearson.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
And I noted that Bill Moyer started out his new PBS series with you and Jacob Hacker and your book, which really shows how over the last 30, 40 years our political system has been hijacked by the super rich. Clearly, Bill Moyer's considered this the most important story around.
That's right. I mean, I think he told us that it was one of the reasons he wanted to come back on the air again was that he feels like these issues of growing economic inequality and the way that they generate a kind of vicious circle of increasing political power, which then translates into increasing economic power again, that this was just an issue that Americans really needed to understand and wrestle with.
Well, it seems to me, Paul Pearson, that at this point, the super rich are in fact displaying a kind of arrogance and hubris that's quite breathtaking. Having almost taken the global economy to a near-death experience, they were bailed out by the average taxpayer. Now they've been made whole. They clearly control our politics. We've seen that there's no way in the world that the Congress can in any way end the Bush tax cuts for the super rich, and they'll do everything. They'll hold the entire government hostage to maintain. They'll go to the mat for that. And now they're running a one percenter for a presidential candidate. Does that strike you as being a bit rubbing it in our face?
Well, I think there have been astonishing developments over the last couple of years in American politics, which really, I think, reinforce the story that Jacob and I are trying to tell in the book, and you summarized them well. I mean, it is amazing to see, a quarter billionaire running as the leading contender with a platform that is about more huge, upwardly skewed tax cuts and more deregulation as the centerpiece of his domestic policy. And of course, every Republican candidate agrees with all that. So, yes, it really is astonishing. I mean, the one thing, I guess, where I might disagree with you just a little, Ian, the way that you're characterizing it, is that I think that there are real differences between the political parties on these issues. I think, you know, whatever criticisms one might have, and I would have many, of the Democratic Congress in 2009 and 2010 and of the Obama administration, the policies that they pursued on health care, on taxation, on financial regulation are substantially different and more favorable to the middle class than those that any Republican administration or Congress would pursue. They're not good enough, and there's lots of room for criticism, and they are, you know, very powerfully affected by these concentrated economic interests that we talk about. But there are very, I think, very important differences between the two parties.
But surely, Paul Pearson, the president has not been successful getting his agenda through, and he's not been able to get the Republicans to budge on the Bush tax cuts.
Well, so that battle is still being played out. Much of their agenda did not get through. But look. So we might disagree about this, but the health care reform bill that was passed is going to it's an important redistributive policy. Much of it is being financed by upper income groups, and many more people are going to receive health insurance as a result of it, especially towards the lower ends of the income distribution. The financial regulations were not enough, but it was way more than you would ever get from a Republican Congress. With respect to taxes, you had, tax policies that are more favorable under a Democratic president than you're going to get from a Republican president. So I don't disagree with you at all about criticizing Washington for not doing more for the middle class over the last few years, but I worry about people seeing the two parties as Tweedledee and Tweedledum when, as we put it in the book, as Jacob and I put it in the book, when it comes to these issues, the Republicans wear black hats and the Democrats wear gray hats. They are their positions are not great on these issues, but they're better than the Republicans.
Well, the thing that I find extraordinary, though, Paul Pearson, is that the Republicans and Mitt Romney actually have a decent chance of getting elected and reelected, because there is so much distress and disquiet out there. One in four homes are underwater. And what's troubling is that it's almost like there's a sort of Stockholm syndrome out there in the electorate, that they are starting to identify with their torturers. Do you think that the president can make a powerful narrative? I know he started out speaking at where Teddy Roosevelt did in Kansas in a kind of opening volley. But it seems to me that given that the Tea Party was formed over outrage about what happened on Wall Street and the left allowed the far right to run with that issue, it feels to me like, you know, there's got to be some more toughness and more clarity.
Well, I think I agree with that. And I think they are, I think the administration is pushing in that direction in terms of how they want to frame their message. And they certainly will. If Mitt Romney is the alternative, I think that will be a gift, at least in respect of making sure that people pay attention to these issues of inequalities of economic opportunity. Look, the big challenge, the reason why Republicans have a good shot in this election is not because people are persuaded by an argument that we need more tax cuts for the wealthy. Or more deregulation. The reason that they've got a good shot is because the unemployment rate is so high. And the unemployment rate is so high because the economy was crashed by Wall Street in 2007 and 2008, and we've had a very, very difficult time crawling back from that, as one might expect. You know, the administration, and again, I don't want to be an apologist for the administration. I have lots of criticisms of practices that they pursued. I think they actually spent too much time hoping that they could craft compromises with Republicans. But they would have done a lot more on these issues if they didn't have to deal with a filibuster in the United States Senate. You know, people think that the majority can just snap its fingers and implement policies. And, of course, this is not – we don't have a parliamentary system where the majority gets to do whatever they want. You know, we have a system increasingly where – the minority can tie things up in knots, you know. And if it had only taken 51 votes in the Senate, you would have gotten a much bigger stimulus package. You would have gotten a better health care bill. You would have gotten much tougher financial regulations than what Democrats were able to do.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Pearson, professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book with Jacob Hacker is Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, just out in a new paperback edition. One of the things that managed to get through was the Dodd-Frank Act. And in your piece with Bill Moyers, there was a general consensus that it was very, very weakened and compromised. And now we've noticed that the one piece of legislation that the president managed to shame the Congress into passing, the Stock Act, that's also been compromised as well. So there is something somebody recently referred to as the wealth protection industry operating on Capitol Hill. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely, and I'm not questioning at all that industry is quite influential within the Democratic Party as well as it is within the Republican Party. You know, we spend some time in the book talking about Chuck Schumer as an example of, you know, what we call Republicans for a day. You know, those Democrats who, when it comes to some powerful economic interest within their district or within their state, you know, they're just as much involved in this wealth protection industry as the Republicans are. And so when you add their obstruction to the obstruction that you get from the GOP, it makes it very, very difficult. So again, we're not trying to let the Democrats off the hook here by any means, but we are suspicious, and we think it's a mistake to treat the two parties as if they're exactly the same. The challenge is to put tremendous pressure, organized pressure, on the Democratic Party to be more responsive to the middle class and the working class and the poor, and not be so needing to accommodate what you call the wealth protection industry.
Well, Paul Pearson, your book, which chronicles in great clarity how our political system has been hijacked by the super rich over the last few decades. The good news, of course, is that you have a conclusion here, beating winner take all. Walk us through some of the because I know the Occupy movement has brought a kind of political consciousness to the broader debate about the disparity of income in this country, the 99% versus the 1%. But could you just quickly walk us through some of your recommendations of how the American people can restore a government
The
people
and, by the people? Obviously, this is the big question. And, you know, a lot of people say that this is a pessimistic book, but we think of it as an optimistic book because when we wrote it, mostly what people were saying about inequality, you know, and again, people need to appreciate how staggering the shift in income distribution has been in the United States over the last 30 years. 40% of all income growth since the late 1970s has gone to the top 1% of the income distribution. So the slogan of Occupy Wall Street is absolutely right. We are the 99%. That's the right way to think about it. But changing it, obviously, is incredibly difficult. You know, one thing that we stress is because this is not just the result of globalization or some kind of natural economic process, you actually can change it if you can change the politics. And we've been through this before. You know, another reason for optimism is that we have been through this before. We have been in situations where the system tilted tremendously towards the economically powerful, and you had then periods of political renewal, the Progressive Era and the New Deal, in which things became somewhat more balanced and the system became more responsive to the middle class. So how do you do that? We do think that there are real opportunities associated with the rise of social media, that this makes it possible for people who are scattered all over the country but have similar concerns to organize and to come together. This needs to happen, though, on a sustained basis. It's not something that can happen just for a day or a month or even a year because what happens in Washington depends on whether people are there for the long haul. Observing what people in Washington are doing and pushing them to do the right thing and holding them accountable if they don't do the right thing. And so if I were to have any criticism of Occupy Wall Street, it's not really even a criticism, but it's just saying, well, what's the next step? The next step has to be, I think, an engagement with the political process in the way that the Tea Party movement has engaged with the political process to try to hold politicians and policymakers accountable. Occupy Wall Street, I think, has been so far, on the whole, skeptical and dismissive about the need for that kind of engagement. But I think if we're going to turn things around, there have to be efforts that involve trying to advance candidates for office who share the beliefs that people who are concerned about these terrible trends believe, and that then hold those elected officials accountable if they don't follow through.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Pearson, professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book with Jacob Hacker is Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. The book is just out in a new paperback edition. I guess in many ways, though, Paul, the key to changing the political dynamics and getting the kind of majority that you mentioned earlier, you have to have a filibuster-proof majority now in the Senate. And we know the Democrats are at a numerical disadvantage in this election cycle. To me, the key to this is how do you the Republicans only get elected with Democratic voters, and the so-called Reagan Democrats are the ones that they always target and somehow win over. So how do you, from your research, what kind of recommendations do you have for them to win back the Reagan Democrats? Because, you know, essentially what they're being told is redistribution of wealth means that your income is cut so that a bunch of lazy minorities, you know, get to be freeloaders rather than who's really stealing the lion's share of the money.
Right. So, there are a number of things to say there. One is that while I do think it's important to try to reach out to all voters who you think would benefit from a different set of policies, and to my mind that means most Americans, you know, though what people often target these Reagan Democrats, they mean, and by that they often mean white working class males. And, you know, one thing we need to recognize is that's a less sizable share of the electorate. Every year it becomes a less sizable share of the electorate. So, I think to fixate on that group is not necessarily the critical thing. You want to make appeals to that group, and there can be appeals to that group. But I think that you can build electoral coalitions in a lot of different ways, especially given the changing demographics of the country. But the other thing, the broader point I would make about this is that Democrats have to make an effective case for why and how government can actually help the middle class rather than hurting the middle class. And for 30 years, partly because of this incredible organizational imbalance that's developed in the American political system, people have been hearing only about the virtues of tax cuts and deregulation. And mostly Democrats have run away from these issues rather than really arguing them. And I think now is an opportunity. I think people are beginning to understand that, sitting here in California, certainly where I am, I think you can start to make a case that says, look, you know, the middle class really has a stake in reversing these policies. And that case has to be made articulately. I actually am hopeful in this presidential election. Again, Mitt Romney is a perfect foil for someone making the case that policies of tax cuts and deregulations have benefited a tiny minority of Americans, and that we need to restore an economic system and a political system that works for the middle class.
But if you are to rescue the endangered middle class, Paul Pearson, and we know that the middle class is in great distress, 1 in 4 homes are underwater, and an awful lot of people are maxed out, and they're susceptible to some of the demagoguery that's going on. So, and we've seen the $26 billion bank bailout for robo-signing, which is barely a drop in the bucket. So it doesn't feel like anybody's really going to the mat for the middle class as much as it's pretty clear that the Republicans are going to the mat for the super rich.
That's absolutely true, right? And that's because there are so many obstacles, right? I mean, this system, the system has become very, very tilted. And there are many ways in which it's becoming even more tilted, right? So we haven't talked yet about Citizens United and the fallout from Citizens United, but the role of super PACs are playing in this electoral cycle is really stunning, even for somebody like me who has been following, you know, very closely the role of big money in politics, to see a handful of people writing huge checks that are becoming of fundamental importance in how Republican primaries play out. It's pretty astonishing to watch. So the danger, of course, is that given all these obstacles, that any positive movement by political figures is going to be disappointing because it's going to be insufficient. And there's no question in the short run that anybody we elect is likely to be disappointing given all the obstacles that we've been talking about. But the challenge then is not to walk away from that or to say, oh, it doesn't matter or there's no difference, these politicians are all the same. It's to keep pushing. So if you think about the people who built the New Deal or the people who built the Progressive Era, which returned some sanity and fairness to our political process and to our economic system, those were folks who were not in the fight just for one election. They knew that they were going to have to push for many, many years and that there were going to be many disappointments.
Well, indeed. I guess in many ways, what's encouraging is that our history's proven that, you know, we did have a gilded age, not unlike the one that we have now, and the plutocrats outspent William Jennings Bryan of something hundreds to one. And he very recently warned at the end of the 19th century that the great challenge is to protect the God-made man from the man-made God, the corporation. And then we got lucky because McKinley, well, it's a terrible thing to say, but he didn't last very long. And then the accidental president showed up, who was a reformer and caught everybody by surprise, Theodore Roosevelt. And so, you know, good things can happen. But I take it what you're saying is that we need more than leadership there. We need people to show up on Capitol Hill because Capitol Hill is swarming with lobbyists, but they're not swarming with the average American citizen.
Right. So that's exactly right, Ian. And I guess luck is always helpful. Fortuitous circumstances, the right person at the right time. But the only way that those opportunities can be utilized is if people are ready and prepared to push when that happens. And we tell the story in the book. I mean, to me, it sums it up, the situation, as well as Annie. And it turns out this story may be apocryphal, but it's a great story anyway, where some group of do-gooders comes to talk to FDR in the White House to argue their case about something, and he listens to them, and then he says, "Fine, you've convinced me. Now make me do it. Make me do it." And what he meant by that was that for me to push something up the hill against all the obstacles in the political system, there have to be people pressuring me and other politicians so that I know it's better for me to do this than to not do it. And that's the kind of situation that we need to recreate. That's the kind of situation that made the New Deal possible, that made the progressive era possible. It wasn't just some magical politician, but it was a talented politician, a dedicated politician who was backed and pushed forward by groups that were encouraging him to do the right thing.
Well, Paul Pearson, I thank you for joining us here today and for your book with Jacob Hacker, Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, just out in a new paperback edition. As I said, Bill Moyer started off his new series with it, and we're starting off our fund drive here with your book because we consider it the most important intellectual ammunition the American people can have to take back their democracy.
Ian, thank you very much for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Pearson, who is a professor of political science at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the author of Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy, which is co-authored with Jacob Hacker, and he also wrote Politics in Time, History, Institutions, and Social Analysis. His latest book with Jacob Hacker is Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, which is just out in paperback. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the communications director of the Syrian American Council. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rashad Al-Dabbagh, who is the Communications Director for the Syrian American Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rashad Al-Dabbagh.
Thank you for having me.
And just the Syrian National Council is a group of Syrian Americans, right? Is it
Syrian American Council.
Yeah. What's the kind of the national population of the Syrian diaspora? Do you know?
There's no exact number, but there's a large concentration in areas such as here in Southern California, as well as in Chicago and New York and Michigan and elsewhere around the country. But as far as exact numbers, I mean, it's within. We don't really have actual numbers now.
You're obviously in touch with your families in Syria. So what are you hearing? Because the majority, it's hard to know how many people support Assad, how many people are sitting on the fence, and how many people have joined the rebellion. So give us your interpretation of what you're hearing to give us a picture of how the forces are arrayed?
The massacres are taking place on a daily basis. More and more people are joining the revolution. The more the brutal it gets, the more brutal the crackdown is, the more people join the revolution. You can't really tell how many people are supporting Assad because people support him because of fear, because they're afraid that any dissent, any opposition, any protest will be faced with a brutal crackdown, as we've seen. So it's not a matter of supporting Assad, it's or being against him. It's there are some who are pro-revolution, and then you have those who are afraid, and those who benefit from the existence of the regime.
So at this point, it would seem to me the key to Assad's survival, clearly the Russians' veto at the United Nations has helped him a lot. And my understanding is that the state media, Assad's media, has made a big deal out of the Russian support and the visit by the Russian foreign minister. It seems that a lot of that is aimed at the Syrian army to sort of shore up their morale. So it seems to me the key issue here is the Syrian army. It's controlled by the Alawite officer corps and the Alawite militia, the Shabiba, apparently in the headquarters you have the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Al-Quds force are directing much of the operation. So we know how the army is held together up until now, but there have been a lot of defections. So give us a sense from what you're hearing from Syria and what your other friends and colleagues in the Syrian National Council are hearing. How would you describe the state of the Syrian army? How much is it cracking?
There's a lot of defections are taking place, and more are taking place as the crackdown gets more and brutal. Those defectors are refusing to point their weapons at the Syrian people and defecting, but many of them are being killed because of their defection from the Syrian army. What we need to do is to support the establishment of safety zones, humanitarian corridors, and in cooperation with Turkey, so we can create those zones where army defectors can be protected at and civilians can be protected. This is no longer acceptable. We are providing nothing but words, and with the Russian veto, we know what the reasons were for the Russian veto. It's close ties with this regime, selling its weapons and arms, as well as its base in Syria. The people of Syria are paying the price, and we can no longer afford watching massacres. We need to take action, real action, not simply words. The Syrian people are dying. Thousands are being killed just today, according to the local coordination committees. More than 100 have been killed, mostly in Homs. The killing is continued on a daily basis. 30 years ago, when the massacres occurred in Hama, nobody knew about it. We couldn't do anything about it. Now we see it every day on the internet through videos and social media, and we're still unable to do anything. It is unacceptable. We at the Syrian American Council think that an immediate action should take place, and more action, not just words, should take place.
Again, I'm speaking with Rashad al-Dabbah, who is the communication director for the Syrian American Council. So if you're calling for safe zones inside of Turkey, I take it that means that the other neighbors, Iraq and Lebanon, are not reliable havens for the Free Syrian Army?
Iraq and Lebanon are not. Iraq and Lebanon are somewhat supportive of of this regime, but the only Turkey and Jordan can cooperate with safety zones, creating safety zones for the people of Syria and the civilians who are being attacked every day, as well as army defectors.
Well, I'm just trying to get an understanding of how, because it seems to me that that with the Russian help, Assad is being shored up, but he has a minority Alawite officer corps and the Shabiba militia that he controls, and the 4th Mechanized Division that his brother controls, the Republican Guards. But the bulk of the Syrian army are Sunni conscripts, and that's where the defections have been taking place. There have been some officers have defected as well. So I'm trying to figure out how they control, keep control over the rank and file in the military. Do they watch them? I mean, I don't know how it's done. If you, on the one hand, they're fighting the rebels. On the other hand, the Alawite officers and the Shabiba must be looking over the shoulder, and making sure that none of their soldiers are trying to run away. I mean, and I take it if they do, they shoot them on the spot. So, how is this process of defection taking place? Is it completely random?
Well, the Alawites in the army. The regime is trying to turn it into an Alawite versus Sunni versus minorities situation, but there you have people from all sides that are opposing and supporting. So the defections are taking place randomly from different parts of the country. This regime has kept a tight control of the country through the Shabiha militias and the security, the Syrian security and the army establishment and the intelligence. The existence of those are everywhere around Syria, especially in the cities of Aleppo and Damascus. Therefore, we haven't seen much protest because it's tightly secured. But around other places around the country where we've seen a lot of protests, that's where there's less security. Hence, we've seen the Syrian army shelling and entering these cities such as Homs and Hama and Daraa.
Well, the shelling of Homs began because a group of Syrian soldiers at a roadblock in the area surrounding the area that the Assad regime doesn't control, they all defected en masse, and that apparently enraged the Alawite officers, and they began their bombardment. So I'm trying to figure out, is there any coordination? Do the rebels have ways to reach out to their fellow soldiers in uniform, encourage them to cross the lines, or is it as you said a minute ago, is it completely random? In other words, I don't see any solution here to this situation in terms of the diplomacy is absolutely dead in the water. The Russians have shut down the United Nations. So I imagine what's going to start happening now is arms are going to come in covertly, probably from Qatar and other countries, to support the rebellion. But actually, the weak link in the Assad regime is the army, surely. I'm correct in focusing on that, aren't I?
Well, the defectors, some of them are forming militias, and they are loosely connected with the Free Syrian Army. And it is difficult, as the Syrian regime has made it difficult on anyone to defect, and many of them are paying the price high. That's why some kind of international involvement is needed and is necessary. This regime is willing to wipe out populations and entire cities for it to stay in existence. So, as I said, it will be a difficult process for the Syrians to do it on their own.
Well, but then let me ask you, Rashad Al-Dabbagh, how do you think the situation is now? There's been this growing rebellion, and the Assad regime is more and more desperate. But are they at a point now where they are you know, stronger or weaker? I mean, you know, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and the President of the United States, Barack Obama, say that this regime is eventually going to go. But eventually could be anything, right?
The fact that it's getting more and more desperate is an indication that it's getting weaker and more defections are taking place and losing more of the international support that it had once. How long is it going to take? It's difficult to know. It's difficult to say. This regime is actively trying to destroy all social ties in the country that have been built for over centuries, and it is willing to do anything to stay in power, even if it means to destroy the entire Syrian nation and its population.
Well, I understand that a lot of the Alawite families are moving up into the mountains. So maybe, you know, some of them see the writing on the wall. But I keep getting conflicting reports. You know, I talk to the Syrian opposition and they say it's just, you know, that Assad is finished. It's just a matter of time. And then you talk to other people who say, well, you know, this regime could hold on for a long time. So, you know, I know you're in touch with people there. I just was trying to get a sense of how long this agony will go on, or whether there's anything that can be done. As I say, it looks like the international community have been basically blocked by the Russian and the Chinese veto.
Well, the regime might stay for longer, but the fact remains that it has lost legitimacy. Its legitimacy, if it ever had one, because we know that this regime is a dictatorship and Bashar is a dictator, son of a dictator. So it never really had legitimacy. But now people are going against it. An international intervention with Turkey and the Arab League and what is now known as the Friends of Syria coalition that was mentioned this week, need to do something regardless of Russia's veto. There are many ways to go around it, whether through NATO or through cooperation with the Turks and the Arab League. There needs to be a support for the revolution and for the Free Syrian Army to end the bloodshed, to put an end to this regime and to weaken this regime in order to see a Syria that will be free from the Assad gang that has ruled Syria for almost half a century.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Rashad Al-Dabbagh.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Rashad Al-Dabbagh, who is a communications director for the Syrian American Council. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.